Welcome to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We start with news for the citrus industry today. Citrus, of course, is one of the hundreds of specialty crops in California, and specialty crops have special challenges.
My Ag Life in Citrus is brought to you by Soil and Crop Incorporated, your number one resource for sustainable crop nutrition by putting nature to work for you.
Two major issues facing agriculture right now, labor shortages and environmental concerns, are already getting major tech-centered solutions from the ag world. Kurt Blades, the Senior Vice President of Ag Solutions at the Association of Equipment Manufacturers, says more solutions are coming.
Well, there are so many exciting things that are happening on the precision ag front right now, whether it is some of the existing technology and getting better at knowing some of the specifics of variable rate technology of planters or sprayers or seeders. That gets very exciting. But we're just right at the cusp of some really interesting innovations as we begin to implement artificial intelligence and advanced sensors into the machines themselves. It's going to be really interesting to see what comes around the corner. When you begin to look at precision ag technology and treating for pests and treating for weed pressure, there are two ways in which that can be done. One is mechanically, the other is through spray. And the beautiful thing about sensors and artificial intelligence being able to identify the particular pests is that both of those practices become available where they haven't been able to be available in the past, or certainly at the level of precision that they're available because of the technology that is just around the corner and built into machines today.
With continued development of artificial intelligence and machine learning, sensor technologies, digital miniaturization, and increased electrification in the tech space, more and more of those technologies are finding their way to the field. That is allowing farmers to tackle some of the environmental challenges the world is facing. The environmental advantage comes from GPS technologies that drive a tractor or combine more accurately, meaning work gets done more quickly and the engine gets turned off sooner. Precision application technologies can significantly reduce the amount of fertilizers and pesticides applied to crops by directing them to only the plants that they're intended for, and not other plants or the bare ground between the rows.
I would encourage everyone to take a look at what's happening in the precision ag market today. It's amazing the amount of technology that's built into a tractor or into a combine or to a sprayer or to a seeder. But I'll tell you what, when you dive just a little bit deeper and look at what's right around the corner, it gets really exciting. Some of the most high-tech, data-intensive applications in technology today are happening in agriculture, and I encourage everyone to take a look at that because it's really exciting to see what the future holds for this technology.
The other challenge facing American farmers is the tight labor market. While labor shortages may be relatively new to the American economy at large, a combination of political and economic pressures have made this a challenge for farmers for more than two decades. And of course, the most impacted segment of the ag economy, specialty crops.
So a specialty crop is a number of things. Specialty crop is a pretty broad term, but it encompasses a number of things like fruits, so apples, strawberries, blueberries, vegetables, green beans, leafy greens like lettuce, cabbage, and then other things. You've got trees, you've got flowers, you've got aquaculture, so fish. It encompasses a number of different things. And so when we talk about specialty crops, it's a very broad term, but there's a lot going on there and a lot going on in each part of specialty crops as well.
That's Austin Gellings, the manager of ag services at AEM, who focuses on specialty crop issues. While specialty crop is a broad term, they frequently share one main commonality, human labor.
It's a very labor intensive at the moment, but one machine has the ability to do on a per hour basis what 20 people are capable of doing. So that's a lot of work saved, and ultimately, that is better on the farmer's bottom line, and it allows us to produce more as well. And on top of that, as COVID has really kind of shined a light on, is the labor shortage and the labor issues that we're seeing all across the industry in the U.S., no matter where you look, but specialty crops especially. And so being mechanized not only allows you to do more, produce more, but it also helps eliminate food waste in the fields because we're able to get it out of there when it needs to get out of there rather than it sitting in the field because we unfortunately just don't have the help to get to harvest the... I'll restart that sentence. Because we unfortunately don't have the help to get that produce out of the field.
and harvesting specialty crops takes special consideration.
Yeah, so the reason that it hasn't really, there hasn't been a lot of mechanization within this market is because specialty crops are delicate. You think of an apple or an orange or a berry, you have to be very delicate with the way you handle that. And so, because what you harvest is ultimately what the consumer ends up buying and seeing at the store, and most people don't want to buy a bruised apple or something like that. So when you look at row crops like corn or soybeans, that's something that you can be a little more harsh with. You still want to be careful, but you know, you can unload it in bulk and you can be a little more rough with it. With specialty crops, you've got to be very delicate in the way you handle it. And then too, when harvesting specialty crops, there's also a way to do it. Not all specialty crops are ripe at the same time, so you have to have a way to identify what's ripe and ready and what's not. And so we're really utilizing technology such as AI to be able to begin to do that.
We hear more from Kurt Blades in segment 3 today. Our news brief is up next. We will be right back.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you. Salty, closed soils can render your crops unproductive. D-Sol, formulated by AgroPlanté, is specially designed for sodic and saline sodic soils. D-Sol will displace sodium and wash it out of the root zone with irrigation to enhance your soil structure, water penetration, and vitality by decreasing soil salinity. AgroPlanté's D-Sol flocculates your soil to promote soil aeration and drainage. With D-Sol, you'll create a better soil environment for your crop roots and optimize yield. Contact AgroPlanté today to find out more at 559-498-0388 or visit us at agroplanté.com. Soil fumigation is a critical step to ensure that your orchard gets off to a good start. Trichlor is a pre-plant soil fumigant and is the foundation for a successful pest management system. Targeted pathogens include soil-borne disease and nematodes. Fumigation helps to create a healthy soil environment that allows the plant's root system to flourish. For more information about Trichlor or to schedule an application, contact Trical Incorporated at 669-327-5076 or visit www.trical.com.
Welcome back. Here's your news for today. The National Farmers Union hosted a webinar Monday to recognize that it's been 100 years since the Packers and Stockyards Act went into law. Americans are paying a lot for meat, not because of the fundamental elements of pork, poultry, or beef have changed, but because of a handful of corporate monopolies that control every aspect of the industry, they say. Four firms control 54% of the poultry, 66% of the hog, and 85% of the cattle markets. NFU says they use this stranglehold to drive up grocery bills and have left our food supply chain vulnerable to cyber attacks and market shocks. NFU says government has the power to fix this. Multinational corporate meat packers can be broken up. The 100-year-old Packers and Stockyards Act was originally intended to protect poultry and hog farmers and cattle ranchers from unfair, deceptive, and monopolistic practices in the meat market. But for the last few decades, under both Democratic and Republican administrations, NFU says USDA has not fully enforced the important protections for farmers and ranchers and has enabled rampant consolidation. Mike Calicrate is a cattle feeder who was involved in a 1990s class action antitrust lawsuit against IBP, which was later bought by Tyson Foods.
I don't know that we can have a fair market with today's current concentration consolidation problem. It's like we've often said, it's hard to have competition when you don't have competitors. And so we've got to do something with antitrust to literally break up the monopoly power. And at the same time, we've got to rebuild this local regional food system, And in order to build that, we're going to have the protection of antitrust and stop the predatory practices of these big multinational corporations. And so we can't just wake up today and say we're going to have competition tomorrow, because there's no solution out there, single solution, or even, you know, two or three perhaps legislative items that can help us get that job done. Because we just don't have the competitors. And the current companies that are there now, it's really important to understand that they cooperate. They do not compete, and they haven't competed for many years. In the years that I've been in the cattle business, you know, I started sensing there was a real problem in about 1988, and I was convinced by 1996 that this is not an industry that there's much future in for an independent business person that wasn't willing to become part of the problem in providing the captive supplies and those animals that produce, that the big meat packers are procuring outside of the competitive marketplace.
And we will continue this conversation in segment four today. Continuing with our news, rural broadband efforts are getting another shot in the arm with new funding in USDA's ReConnect program. Gary Crawford has more.
If you live in a rural area and you cannot connect to high-speed internet, or even low-speed for that matter, you're not alone. President Biden says
millions of Americans lack access to reliable high-speed internet, including more than 35% of rural America.
To try to bridge this digital divide, the U.S. Department of Agriculture has been operating what is called a ReConnect program. It provides loans and grants to help bring high-speed internet to unserved and hard-to-reach rural areas. Since that program began in 2018,
about 300,000 households have been positively impacted by this, and we're going to expand this with this announcement today.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack in Illinois last week to announce that USDA will soon start taking applications for loans and grants to do rural broadband projects. This from a ReConnect fund of
$1.15 billion in the form of grants, loans, and combination grant and loans to facilitate expansion of better access to internet and broadband in rural places and unserved areas.
And he says, if nothing else, the pandemic has made this an even bigger issue.
This is just incredibly important for rural communities, whether it's telemedicine or distance learning, or whether it's a small business market development opportunity, or farmers who need this for precision agriculture, or to just to know what the markets are on a particular day. If you don't have adequate access, you're really in a situation where you're behind.
Vilsack said the idea is not just to be able to say a certain area has access to some kind of internet service some way, somewhere, but also
to make sure that when we have broadband, we have sufficient upload and download speeds that people can actually do what needs to be done. You can't have adequate broadband if only one person in a household can use it at a time. You can't have adequate broadband if your schools don't have distance learning opportunities, or if your hospital or clinic doesn't have telemedicine opportunities. You just don't have access, and it's just unfair.
Now, just over $1 billion in these available ReConnect program monies for rural broadband sounds like a lot of money, and Vilsack told us, yes, it is.
But at the end of the day, we really do need a national commitment of a significant size to really make a fundamental difference in rural places.
Congress is now working on the infrastructure and budget reconciliation bills. These currently have proposals for about $65 billion to end what Vilsack calls the unfair digital divide between urban and rural areas.
This should not be a situation of whatever your zip code is that you have service or don't have service.
This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Remembering to defrost the turkey might not be the only challenge families face as they try to get that perennial centerpiece onto the Thanksgiving table this year. As of August 31st this year, inventories of frozen whole turkeys and turkey parts were 24% lower than three-year average volumes, that according to USDA's Economic Research Service. Stocks of frozen turkey meat typically follow a seasonal pattern, building throughout the year until they fall when retailers prepare to meet holiday demand. Continued research of and innovation within sustainable agricultural systems is the intent of recent USDA grants, Rod Bain reports.
Advancing research in sustainable agricultural systems.
We really wanted to make sure that we were investing in projects that were aimed at improving robust, resilient, and climate-smart food and agricultural systems.
That, according to USDA National Institute of Food and Agriculture Director Carrie Castile, she says this investment is the latest in a series within the Agricultural Food and Research Initiative.
AFRES is the nation's leading and largest competitive grants program for agricultural sciences, and we help support eligible colleges, universities, and other research organizations.
And its Sustainable Agricultural Systems Program.
The grants are eligible to colleges and universities and other research institutions, and we were pleased that we had $146 million in projects to be able to fund.
In total, 15 projects are funded under these grants.
A third of those supported our minority-serving institutions.
With examples of projects funded through the Sustainable Ag Systems Research Grants, including
Central State University and its multidisciplinary team partnered with the 1890 Land Grants and Historically Black Colleges and Universities, as well as the 1994 Land Grant Tribal College and the 1862 Land Grant Universities. It's going to investigate using hemp as an aquaculture feed ingredient to address food safety concerns about consuming seafood raised with hemp feed additives. They're also going to research ways to increase economic markets and production sustainability for both seafood and hemp.
As well as a project headed by the University of California.
UC researchers and their partners aim to alleviate groundwater overuse and sustain irrigated agriculture in the Southwest United States. They're going to develop innovative education programs as well as novel extension programming to support sustainable groundwater and irrigated agricultural systems, create models including geophysical, hydrological, biophysical, as well as socioeconomic models, as well as developing climate change adaptation management strategies, and produce effective decision support tools.
Director Castile says the overall goal in this sustainable agricultural system research effort is
making sure that we're developing solutions that are going to feed our families, improve profitability for producers, improve forest and soil health, while looking at new opportunities throughout our agricultural system.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
The United States and European Union Sunday announced an end to the trade conflict of steel and aluminum tariffs, welcoming news for agriculture. The United States will not apply Section 232 duties and will allow duty-free importation of steel and aluminum from the EU at a historical-based volume, and the EU will suspend related tariffs on U.S. products. That's our news for today. We will be right back.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
Network with the top tier of the industry at this year's California Trina Conference. Featuring presentations from the top executives from CDFA and California's tree nut commodity boards. Register at WCNGG.com and we'll see you in Tulare on November 3rd at the California Tree Nut Conference.
Welcome back. We heard earlier from Kurt Blades, the Senior Vice President of Ag Services at the Association of Equipment Manufacturers, on ag equipment solutions for specialty crops. Here are more of his comments.
When farmers make the decision to adopt precision ag technology, oftentimes it takes that one killer app. For precision agriculture, it's auto steer or tractors that can drive themselves. Because regardless of the economics, a farmer can easily point to a tractor that drives itself in straight rows and immediately pick up on the benefits. Whether that's longer hours or less fatigue or simple fuel savings, it becomes very easy for a farmer to make that calculation in their head. So that's kind of the killer app that leads everybody into the system. But once you've done that, then you can continue to grow, and you recognize when a tractor knows where it is in a field, it begins to collect data. And that data that it collects continues to add value to the production, allows a farmer to make good decisions on its crop production practices, as well as even getting into things like, getting into things such as variable rate technology or different hybrid selections based off of particular pieces of a field. But the entry point is oftentimes that tractor that knows where it is in the field and has the ability to drive itself through the field. That's over there. Isn't it? No, that's in here.
Yeah. I have my phone with me.
It's not my phone, that's in the speakers.
Yeah. I mean, I'm glad it started after the How bizarre.
How bizarre.
That is weird.
It's an incoming call. Ignore. Okay.
It must be ringing at your desk, Justin.
No, it was coming into the room. It's the room phone.
Yeah.
Stop it! Every time I move forward, I lose my sitting on my jacket, and then I get this puffy thing again. I just turned it on so I could answer it.
Oh, that's even weirder.
Don't call here.
Exactly.
Well, let's see what happens. Okay. All right.
That was a little rambly, but there's probably enough in there that you can work
with. No, that was really good stuff. Next one. Why are farmers preferring those features?
Well, farmers buy precision ag equipment for multiple reasons. The first reason oftentimes because it makes sense. It makes sense for a tractor to drive itself. But then as they get deeper into it, they certainly recognize that there are significant efficiencies that can be gained when you know more about what's going on in your field, whether it's through a yield map or whether it's through a soil map or whether it's through, the variable rate technology that's included in a lot of the equipment. Farmers adopt this equipment because it makes good economic sense for them. Now, the added benefit that we like to talk about is that it makes good sense for a farmer, financially, but it also has a societal gain, as oftentimes there's less inputs involved, whether it's less diesel fuel or less active ingredient or crop protection chemicals. That's ultimately very good for the environment as well.
All right. As we get closer to harvest time, you said you weren't digging the harvester's question, right?
Right.
Can you share any new precision ag ideas that equipment manufacturers have developed in the past year?
Well, there are so many exciting things that are happening on the precision ag front right now, whether it is some of the existing technology and getting better at knowing some of the specifics of variable rate technology of planters or sprayers or seeders. That gets very exciting. But we're just right at the cusp of some really interesting innovations as we begin to implement artificial intelligence and advanced sensors into the machines themselves. It's going to be really interesting to see what comes around the corner. So you think about a piece.
Keep going.
Yeah, waiting for the pause here. It's very exciting to see what's happening around the corner in precision agriculture. When you think about machines that have advanced sensors and have artificial intelligence built into the machine, it's pretty amazing when you think about what is just around the corner. Whether that's a machine that has the ability to identify weeds and treat them specifically, or identify pests specifically and deal with something on the fly, we're at the cusp of some really great technology that I think farmers will begin to see in their fields within the next year or two.
Okay. Just for my own purposes and illustrative purposes, so I can hunt down some B-roll to kind of illustrates what you're talking about there. Can you tell me any specific?
I would go to John Deere's Blue River Technologies, but they get a lot of press. So if you can find somebody besides Blue River, even better.
Okay.
Blue River's got great stuff, and they got great videos. They use the term See and Spray, and that is a term of theirs. So, you know, let's go with something more generic like See and Treat, or Weed Identify and Treat.
Okay.
When you talk about it.
Okay.
Really cool stuff, by the way.
Yeah.
Really fascinating stuff.
Oh, it always looks that way.
And the other thing, let me answer this as a way.
Sure.
When you think about, precision agriculture technology, there's two methods. You've got the mechanical when you begin to look at precision ag technology and treating for pests and treating for weed pressure, there are two ways in which that can be done. One is mechanically, the other is through spray. And the beautiful thing about sensors and artificial intelligence being able to identify the particular pests is that both of those practices become available where they haven't been able to be available in the past, or certainly at the level of precision that they're available because of the technology that is just around the corner and built into machines today.
Cool.
That was a nothing burger, but it sounded really good in my head when I said it.
We'll get some meat out of there.
Yeah.
What else should we know about precision ag as far as for the first half of this year?
The most interesting thing to look at precision ag, and I would encourage everyone to really dive into the technology, understand what is available today, which is pretty advanced, but also look around the... What's important for everyone to know about precision agriculture today, let me say it a different way. I would encourage everyone to take a look at what's happening in the precision ag market today. It's amazing the amount of technology that's built into a tractor or into a combine or to a sprayer or to a seeder. But I'll tell you what, when you dive just a little bit deeper and look at what's right around the corner, it gets really exciting. Some of the most high-tech, data-intensive applications in technology today are happening in agriculture. And I encourage everyone to take a look at that because it's really exciting to see what the future holds for this technology.
Kurt Blades with the Association of Ag Equipment Manufacturers. Coming up next, we have more on the Packers and Stockyards Act right after this.
The California Walnut Board and Commission provides value to the California walnut industry by working together with growers and handlers to advance the industry. Together, the California Walnut Board and Commission are helping to protect, develop, and grow California walnuts domestically and internationally. The California Walnut Board provides funding and strategic direction on walnut production and post-harvest research designed to help support the industry and promote California walnuts. To learn more, visit our website at walnuts.org. Together we grow. Agromayor Nursery is the premier nursery in California. Whether it's almonds, walnuts, pistachios, prunes, or olives, Agromayora has been the grower's source for over 20 years and is the home of Rootpack R Almond, Grizzly Walnut, and the North American plants UCB1 and Platinum Clonal Pistachio Rootstocks. As the worldwide leader in super high-density almonds, olives, and prunes, Agromayora can show you how to cut costs and increase yields with their super high-density rootstock Rootpack 20. For more information or to schedule a site visit, contact a representative at 530-812-3398 today.
Welcome back. We continue with the National Farmers Union webinar on the 100 years of the Packers and Stockyards Act. Dairy farmer Sarah Lloyd of Wisconsin gave her perspective as a dairy producer.
Great to be here. My name is Sarah Lloyd. I'm a dairy farmer. I farm with my husband. We're here in Wisconsin, and we're kind of a medium-sized farm by Wisconsin standards. We're milking about 450 cows. And you might say, well, I thought this was about beef. Why are they talking to a dairy farmer? So as a dairy farmer, I'm a beef farmer. We send our male calves into the market to be bought and then raised up for the beef market when our milking cows are done with their milking life. The healthy animals go into the beef market. So I'm actively in the beef market. I went by my in-laws. We're three families on a farm together. And I looked at our settlement from this past week. We sent seven bull calves to market and got a range of $45 to $128 for those animals. And, you know, we spend a lot of time getting them colostrum, vaccinating them, keeping them real healthy so that they'll be really good animals into the market. And, you know, that's actually a better price than we've been getting. There were some times in the past couple of years where the trucker was nice enough to zero out our negative balance because we didn't even get a price that covered the transportation. And I think that is really emblematic of what's going on here, is that we can't cover our cost of production. And that's what I'm asking for. Attorney General Ellison said, I want a fair shot in the market, and I'm not getting it. So we're a family. We've been dairy farming here, my husband's family, for over 100 years. And I don't know, you know, what the next generation could do if we can't fix these markets and get rid of the monopoly power.
Minnesota's Attorney General Keith Ellingson opened the session. Here are his comments.
You know, I think it was maybe 2017 when the Secretary of Agriculture, Sonny Perdue, was in one of America's leading dairy states, Wisconsin, next door neighbor of us here in Minnesota. And he was speaking to a bunch of dairy farmers, and he said, you know what, you got to get big or you got to get out. And the only folks who are going to be able to survive are the ones who get bigger. Everybody else is going to be gobbled up and gone. And when I read that, that struck me as exactly the opposite of what the goals of antitrust law are. It shouldn't be the you got to get big or get out. It should be we're trying to regulate the big, make sure that we have fair markets for the small, and that we have not only good prices, but we also have fair competitive markets where families can maintain their farms and ranches over the course of generations, where they can pay their workers a fair wage, and where we can have shared prosperity, not just prosperity for some. You know, that struck me as odd, but something struck me as hopeful when I really began to see, you know, we were able to establish caucus in Congress on antitrust, and a number of members wanted to join. And now people like Dave Cicilline and Ro Khanna and others are really pushing the ball forward. You know, they started out talking about, you know, the big tech companies, and they absolutely need to be regulated. And the foreclosure crisis of 2008 showed us that the banks absolutely were, you know, too big to fail means you should be, you're too big to exist. You know, those taught us some critical lessons. But really, now we need to think about the ag sector. And in my view, if everyone in America is in the ag sector, because if you eat, you're in the ag sector. If you had a meal, then you better be worrying about ag. You may not have ever put on a pair of boots or fixed a fence or drove out in a pickup truck to drop off a salt lick. That may not be your life. You may not know anything about it. But if you sat down for dinner, you better think a farmer. And the bottom line is that so many of us are only one or two generations off the farm. My mom spent every day of her life until she was 22 years old, married my dad, on a farm in Louisiana. And, you know, growing up there, it's not just that the farm that was in my family was a business. It was a way of life. And to think that some big monster company can just gobble up and take away, I find deeply, deeply offensive, not just economically, but also culturally. And I don't think we should forget about that. Truth be told, that, you know, that today is a good day, a very good day to recognize the importance of a historic piece of legislation that came together in 1921. The Packers and Stockyard Act is a critical piece of legislation designed from the beginning to make sure that concentration in livestock, poultry, and other areas did not destroy the competitiveness of markets and the opportunity for people to participate and make a living in the face of giant conglomerates. You know, the bottom line is that we need real movement, and it can't just be a congressional movement. It can't just be a lawyer's movement, and it can't just be folks who are presently directly participating in agriculture, because they're only about 3% of the population. We need a national movement that make sure that we have a strong, robust, vibrant, competitive agricultural sector that has many, many actors, many, many players, that the people who make the food are respected, their dignity is protected, and that the big monster companies that try to take advantage of everybody are held in check and reduced. So we know the American meat supply faces an overwhelming concentration crisis. Historic consolidation in the industry has enabled dominant multinationals to squeeze farmers, ranchers, workers, and consumers in order to transfer record profits to themselves and shareholders. Corporate meatpackers abuse their market power, employing exploitive arrangements such as contract farming, price fixing, and unfair growing arrangements to extract and suck out an increasing untenable share of profit from livestock producers. In the past decade, farmers' share of cattle market profits dropped by 9%, even as meatpacking giants like Tyson Foods and JBS saw 34% and 66% increase in revenue over the same period. So as the big are getting bigger, the people who actually make the meat are getting less of a share, and that is wrong and unfair, something we have to come together to stop and reverse. We're seeing record numbers of small and family farmers losing their farms. As I mentioned in my introduction, this is not just an economic challenge. It is a cultural one. America is every American's one or two or three generations off the farm. Not every, but nearly all. Certainly in my case, and I bet people on this call, it's true. And so we've got to protect not just the economy, but also the cultural aspects of this, to me, are very important. And the reduction and the concentration that we're seeing among small, medium-sized producers and the record losses we're seeing is not because small farmers or medium-sized farmers and ranchers are not good business people. They're extremely efficient. They know what they're doing. They have generations of know-how. They're up to date. They're technologically sound. No, the answer is because the decisions made by four companies who control 80% of the beef market and the public officials who are supposed to regulate it simply are not stepping up, and it's time to get them to. Let me give you an example. From 1995 to 2017, the federal government gave out $205 billion in farm subsidies. That's a lot of money. $205 billion is a lot of money anywhere. And to give it to farm subsidies, great. Absolutely. Maybe my cousin in Natchitoches Parish is going to be able to keep things going. Oh, wait a minute. Hold on. It depends on where the subsidies are going, right? 26% of that money went to 1% of the recipients, an average of 1.7 million per company. 77% went to 10% of the recipients. 3/4 to 10%? That don't seem like a equitable program. 50 people on the Forbes Richest 400 receives farm subsidies. And you know who didn't get any? You know who got nothing? 62% of all farmers. Now that's not right. That is not right. We have because one thing you know if you study market concentration in 2021 is that it's not just markets that are concentrated, it is our politics that are concentrated. Once you concentrate economic power, first thing you do is go rent yourself some members of Congress and hire up some lobbyists to get more of the same, to the disadvantage of people who are actually raising cattle. Meatpacking conglomerates bullied and maneuvered and lobbied Washington into ever weaker workplace protections and food industry oversight, leaving our food supply chain vulnerable, cyber attacks, disasters, market concentrations. This summer, we saw drought running through Minnesota. It was particularly hard on some of the small producers, and that was a very, very disheartening thing to see. But they're tough, and they're doing their best, but they need some help, just like the big guys get. Uncompetitive livestock markets compromise American health, safety, and food security. This was visible in the early months of the pandemic. Shutdowns and slowdowns at key meatpacking plants can, in addition to threatening workers' health and livelihoods, damage markets for farmers and the availability and affordability of meat for consumers. The government must act because it has the power to act, and we need to make the demand. One of my great heroes of the past, a guy named Frederick Douglass, said, "Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will." And that stands true to this very moment. Multinational corporate meat packers can be broken up. The 100-year-old Packers and Stockyards Act was originally intended to protect poultry and hog farmers and cattle ranchers from unfair, deceptive, and monopolistic practices in the meat market. In order to reverse today's rampant consolidation, largely a result of a historic antitrust under-enforcement, a robust recommitment to these important protections for farmers and ranchers is critical. We on this Zoom call today are committed, and we need to get more people, win more people over to the cause. Here are some good ideas I think could make a difference. I think we might consider breaking up agribusiness monopolies in seeds, chicken, hog, and beef processing, and supermarkets. We need to support the executive order, and I just want to thank President Biden and Vice President Harris for issuing that executive order on competition. It's what we need. It's up to the moment. It's appropriate to the time, and it's a good thing. We need to tell a bigger story. And I want to support their efforts to address meatpacking consolidation and promote competition in the industry. And I want to be clear. I'll confess that me and the president are in the same party, but what I'm saying is not a partisan statement. Honestly, I think we need to work hard to build a bipartisan coalition. I don't think that there's Republican monopoly or Democratic monopoly. It's just monopoly to the farmers trying to make a living, and we need to be there and build a coalition on all, both sides of the political aisle. And whoever won't step up and help, we need to expose them, quite frankly. Another idea, we need to hold the meatpacking industry accountable by strengthening inspection, slowing the speed of lines, promulgating stronger occupational and safety standards, and raising the pay of inspectors. We need to restore the grain inspection, Packers and Stockyard Administration. We need to address consolidation through the Farm Bill, reform the checkoff program, eliminate exemptions in labor laws so that overtime, minimum wage, and right to collective action rules apply for farm workers. And we need to get states' attorney general all over this country who are more than willing to step up and be part of this fight. The administration and state AGs across political lines can be very powerful allies in the effort to reinstitute true competition and shared prosperity in the agricultural sector. I can't think of a better time to start it now. And let me say to you, let's celebrate and draw inspiration from that critical piece of legislation passed about 100 years ago. The Meatpackers and Stockyards Act was a time when people a lot like us were facing the same problem that we are now. They did something about it. Time for us to step up and do the same.
That webinar again was from the National Farmers Union. That's our show for today. If there's a topic you'd like to hear more about, send me an email to sabrina@myaglife.com. This is the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson from the JCS Marketing Team. Thanks for listening.